Axis Mundi.
It was a sort of image you would find in any gay pride parade or LGBTQ-friendly bookshop. It featured the Madonna, the Virgin Mary, and baby Jesus. Except in this image, the halos around Mary and Jesus had been filled in with the rainbow pride colors. But this image got one Polish activist in a lot of trouble. In the early morning of May 6, 2019, police in Poland burst into the home of Elisbieta Polesna, ransacking it and detaining the middle-aged civil rights activist. On X, Polish Minister of Interior Brzezinski announced Polesna's offense, accusing her of, quote, profaning the image of the Częstochowa, Mother of God, unquote. If true, this would be a violation of Poland's blasphemy law, prohibiting words or actions that offend the religious feelings of others, a crime that's punishable by up to 2 years in prison. So who was this Częstochowa, Mother of God, whom Podlesna had profaned? Also known as the Black Madonna of Częstochowa, she is a beloved Byzantine icon housed in a Catholic monastery in southern Poland, a monastery to which she was brought 600 years ago from Constantinople by a prince. According to Poles, the icon's arrival at the monastery coincided with a dramatic defeat of Swedish invaders, and she was henceforth credited with that victory, leading the king at the time to crown her, this icon of Black Madonna, as the Queen of Poland. Over centuries, veneration of Częstochowa, Mother of God, only grew, cementing her place at the center of Polish national identity. And so when Podlesna and several of her fellow women's rights activists peppered buildings one night in late April 2019 with posters of Częstochowa and that rainbow-colored halo, turning her into an icon for LGBTQ rights, it was meant as a provocative act of cultural activism, a reclamation of this beloved figure to bless a community that had become a scapegoat of Polish nationalists who claimed Częstochowa for their cause of so-called family values. If the intent was to poke the bear, it worked. The courts acquitted Podlesna and her fellow activists 2 years later, but their activism had already served its purpose, galvanizing a national conversation. It had also sparked a global response, including from the U.S. Episcopal Church, who asked and received permission from Podlesna to sell T-shirts of the Polish resistance's Black Madonna and her rainbow halo. The U.S. Church sent the money raised from those T-shirt sales back to Poland to help fund legal aid for its transgender community, an act of global religious solidarity in recognition of a shared struggle.
Welcome to American Unexceptionalism. I'm Matthew Taylor.
And I'm Susie Hayward. This is the show where we ask what Americans can learn from those who have resisted religious nationalism and authoritarianism around the globe.
We interview scholars and activists about the strategies they used, the lessons they learned in their fight against oppressive religious regimes.
The United States is facing a very serious Christian nationalist threat to democracy. But we aren't alone in this fight. It's time to put our American exceptionalism behind us to learn how to create a future for all of us.
So far, we've traveled from the Americas to East Asia and begun to making our way back to the U.S. Last week, Turkey served as our bridge between East and West. Today, we're traveling further westward into Europe to learn about what's going on in Poland and surrounding countries.
We've seen throughout our episodes the fate of U.S. politics is deeply connected with countries across the globe, sometimes unexpectedly. Who would have thought that Buddhist monks in Sri Lanka were campaigning for Trump, or that white Christian nationalists in the U.S. were looking up to a Korean-American immigrant pastor whose theology is shaped by his family's experience fleeing North Korea in his childhood? We've traced the transnational cultural and political alliances across the world, noting all the long-haul flights taken by those seeking to build a global anti-democratic movement cast in the religion of the majority community in whatever place their plane lands.
Europe is not so far a leap from the U.S., figuratively or literally. Many of the United States' closest NATO allies are in Europe, and there's a long history of migration and cultural cross-pollination between the U.S. and the European nations. Today, we'll be talking about Europe in general. We're going to focus especially on Poland. Poland is, arguably, the most Catholic and the most religious, at least by measure of population, in Europe. And there are deep organizational and thematic ties between the Catholic right in Poland and the Catholic far right in the U.S. In fact, some far-right militias in the U.S. will travel to Poland to learn from some of their far-right groups. Poland also has some very close-up experiences within the last decade with religious authoritarianism and resistance. So let's bring in our experts on Poland and Europe.
I'm Joel Day, and I'm the Managing Director of the University of Notre Dame Democracy Initiative.
I'm Jonathan Lomascolo, and I'm the Deputy Director of Faith and Democracy, which is a small new NGO focused on countering religious right on a global scale.
And today we are talking about Europe, and especially about Poland, and the tumultuous events that have occurred in Poland in the last decade. As we are getting started, Joel, maybe you can help us understand some of those tumultuous events and give us a little history of modern day Poland.
Poland's this really unique case, perhaps in the whole world, where the nation has become, you know, so sacralized. It actually started with the sacredness of the church as being sort of the central identity, and then the nation sort of built around that rather than the other way around. And it's because of this sort of intrinsically religious identity that, you know, Poland is this sort of venerated model, and maybe we can talk about this later, but the Patriot Front and neo-Nazis and Proud Boys, many of them will look to the far right in Poland and the Catholic identity in Poland as this sort of model that they want to create in other places like the United States. And that's kind of where I start. All nations have this sort of myth and lore and liturgy that are tied to national identity. Poland's was Catholic from the very beginning, from its founding in 966. You know, Catholicism has endured long periods of Polish identity, even, you know, from 1795 to 1918, that period of statelessness when Poland didn't exist as a state, sort of Polish Catholic identity did exist. And during moments of occupation, whether Nazis or during the Soviet occupation period, Catholicism endures as this centralized, unifying national identity. And there are scholars, Kutzner and Zubrinski, who have argued that Catholicism is sort of this national unifying script for collective rebellion against whoever is occupying them at the time, whatever their external foe is. And now into modernity, what's really interesting is Polish Catholicism is being leveraged by many on the right as part of an identity against globalism, against the European Union, against gender identity, and against LGBT communities, and secularism in general. And so the through current all of this is definitely Polish Catholic identity, but it's been leveraged in multiple different ways throughout history.
Joel, I feel like I've seen or I've heard before about this image of the Black Madonna that's really important in Polish Catholic history. Can you tell us about that?
In 1655, there was a war between Poland and the Swedish state, and 4,000 Swedes came into this town where this shrine now is. There was a monastery, and the story goes that about 70 monks held this fortress and this church for 40 days against 4,000 Swedes that were coming to take it over. And at this shrine is a very famous picture of what they call Black Madonna, Madonna with darkly colored skin. And Our Lady of Częstochowa is sort of this redemptive story about repelling an external attack, and that it was in the church. It was monks, it was fathers, it was priests who prayed with Our Lady of Częstochowa and delivered Poland from this occupation. Well, the king then quickly, a year later, named Our Lady of Częstochowa as the Queen of Poland. And Mary's queenship of Poland has been part of this Catholic identity that has enshrined itself in what we mean by Polishness. If we're going to talk about who runs Poland, well, it's Mary. And that has been part of the national identity for quite some time. Really, in the 20th century, rehabilitated by the church itself. And to answer your question directly, there have been forces within the church, those who run Radio Maria and other priests, who have taken on this mantle of national leadership, of moral leadership. And the high court has even said that symbols like the cross, the symbols of pictures of Mary, are part of their national identity so much that in 1998, in a court case, they said that those sort of symbols guarantee the, quote, moral order of the state. And so there really is this very intricate web where the church and the state are wed in national memory.
So let me see if I can summarize a little, and you can tell me if I'm getting this wrong. But so there's always been this component of Catholicity to Polish identity, even going back 1,000 years. And that has kind of sustained and upheld Polish people through all these stages of their history, and even been a source of kind of motivation for resistance to other forms of takeover or authoritarianism. But in comparison with what we have here in the US, right, where maybe 25% of the population is Catholic, we're talking about the vast, vast majority of the population being Catholic, and that Catholic Church is now structuring the internal life of Polish identity and Polish nationality to such a degree that it's almost the governing force. It's kind of what the kind of American Catholic far right dreams of for the United States is the kind of status quo in Poland. Is that fair?
I think that the church has used that as justification for getting more and more involved in politics. There's been this sort of history of Poland as being this place where war takes place, statelessness takes place, occupation takes place. And so the church and politicians have used that in order to reframe sort of Polish identity as what they call Christ among nations, and the most Marian of nations, and that Mary experienced these, you know, seven sorrows. Poland has experienced sorrows throughout their identity. And that sort of narrative of sacrifice, crucifixion, and messianism through a resurrected Polish state, especially in 1989, 1990, there is this self-determination that is tied up with resurrection narratives and messianic narratives that sort of culminates with the ascendancy of John Paul II, that we have achieved our full Christ among nations status with a Polish pope.
I mean, I thought Americans were being pretty pretentious, American Christians, by claiming we are a city on a hill, that Jesus spoke about America way back in antiquity, and here we are fulfilling prophecy. It's another thing entirely to claim you are the Christ among nations, the Mary among the nations. I mean, that is a very kind of centralizing narrative.
Well, Matt, that's right. But think about becoming a country where you have throughout, you know, Poland just celebrated its 1,000-year anniversary. So you've been a people, and you've had nationness for 1,000 years, where there have been hundreds of years where you've had that taken away from you, you've been occupied, your borders have constantly changed. Poland has had border changes dozens of times. And so if you are coming into modern nationhood in the 1990s and you're looking for where you ground your identity, certainly you have this history. Everybody's Catholic. You have this history of Catholic identity, but you also don't really have consistent borders. You don't have a national army that's been all an occupying force from Russia. You don't have an education network. You don't have a national unifying patriotic education that has been taught over the generations. All you have is this story, Our Lady of Częstochowa, the Polish Catholic identity. And so it's very easy for everyone to sort of use that as the grounding from which to start civic consciousness.
I'm picking up here on a thread that we hear from some of our other contexts too, of the something of the politics of vulnerability, the external threats that are constantly bearing down, and that this becomes this sort of appeal to national identity and the role of religion in it becomes a rallying cry to mobilize the community. But you mentioned John Paul II and his role in the emergence of the modern Polish state. And I wonder if you can say a little bit more about the introduction of democracy and the role of Catholicism in that and how those two became linked during that period. And then how that shifted with the rise of the far-right movement.
Yeah, so the Solidarność movement or Solidarity movement was so unifying in the resistance to the USSR and the rise of democracy. And John Paul II was sort of this catalyst figure. The other figure, of course, was Lech Wałęsa, who was the leader of Solidarity and then the first president of Poland in the modern era in 1990. And to the point of all of this, he was a central unifying figure, not necessarily left or right, and everyone sort of got behind Solidarity from a workers' leftist perspective, Catholic families on the right perspective. And Wałęsa wore a lapel pin on every public speech he ever gave. He wore this lapel pin that was Our Lady of Częstochowa. There was a picture of the Queen of Poland on his lapel pin. The point that you just emphasized about national vulnerability and about threats from the outside, this was also mobilized with Poland as a young democracy. There was a real sense that if we as Poland don't guard ourselves, we are going to be incredibly vulnerable to outside forces again, like we have been in the future. And so even in the surge of democracy, it was extremely nationalist in orientation. It was about establishing firm borders, about growing the military, about guarding ourselves against outside threats. And unfortunately, the far right in Poland, which then culminated more recently in PiS or the Law and Justice Party, these issues were malleable in a democratic context where the issues of the day, whatever the issues of the day are, the far right transforms into this resistance narrative. So we first start with Soviets. We're resisting against the Soviets. But increasingly in the 1990s, the popular discourse around secularization, globalization, whether we should join the EU or not join the EU or NATO, these more recently in gender politics, it's about Polish national resistance against outside forces versus the true Polish identity, which is guarded by Mary and our collective Catholic identity. And so I want to guard us that even in a democracy, it is very easy for popular nationalist discourse to pervade politics. And Tim Snyder's work, his first book, was all about the transition to democracy in young countries where it's very easy to skip the democracy part and the pluralism part and the multiracial part and the interreligious part and go just straight to the nationalism. And that has been more or less the nature of the right Catholic movements in Poland.
I get asked this question all the time, Joel, and I think it's partly because I study kind of obscure and relatively new far-right religious movements and leaders, and people, but I always get asked, if these people took over, what would it look like? How would it change the policies? And I'm always saying, like, I don't know, because they've never had power before. They've never been able to take over before. I can tell you what they say, but it's all kind of extrapolation. Here we actually have a very concrete case of the Catholic far right taking over, at least for periods, because there has been a back and forth within Polish politics. So when this far right Catholic contingent has been in power, what has policymaking looked like? How have they approached questions like the rights of religious minorities, Jewish folks? How have they approached the rights of racial minorities, the rights of sexual minorities? How have they exercised the power and the ideology that they have articulated when they actually are in a position to do so?
One of the groups that I am particularly interested in is this All Polish Youth Movement, Wyciech Polska. And I was actually in Poland during the height of their power. So they were refounded in 1989 by a far-right politician affiliated with the League of Polish Families. Well, the League of Polish Families had a heyday in 2005 and 2006. And the founder of this All Polish Youth Group became the Minister of Education during in this government that was a coalition government, very right wing. And what that looked like was a precursor to what we're living through in the United States. Again, like I said at the very top of this, Poland is looked at as a very important model, a venerated model. If we get power, what can we do? So the League of Polish Families, through the Ministry of Education, began to comb through libraries and eliminate controversial books from public libraries. They began to take the question about gender health very seriously and first made it voluntary and then took out gender health, sexual health, reproductive health out of schools entirely. There have been later on, when they were out of power, but still very active in pushing the Law and Justice Party, which kind of took over the far right mantle, pushing for what became known as like no-go zones, where LGBTQ folks were legally, but more culturally, prohibited from entering towns, and that they would be physically assaulted in some of these neighborhoods by members of this party. And so you can see, whether it's education or the exclusion of LGBTQ folks from public life in general, we just lived through massive amounts of protests for trans story hours in the United States and protests against pride rallies. Those were hallmarks of this period in Poland when the League of Polish Families was in power, and it seems to be a playbook that the United States far right is learning from.
Is this just kind of all going on in the background? Are there protests going on, like pro-LGBTQ protests, even as these things are being enacted, or is the resistance to it pretty quiet?
I do think there are moments of very strong resistance. So the most recent political contest has been around health class. The new center government, center left-ish government, has put health class back into schools that were previously taken out. And just this past week, the Catholic bishops called on all Catholics to not participate. Do not send your kids, don't go. And so the big debate at the moment is around whether or not classes can even exist that teach that, you know, gender is a spectrum, that we're able to live a full life and human dignity, even if you exist somewhere on that spectrum that isn't male or female. And these are quickly turning into protests, national rallies on the right. Now, I could see a world in which that sets the groundwork for something happening very quickly if the government were to turn again at the next election, where there is this narrative that is already set up that they're sexualizing our children. We have a bunch of NGOs that are perhaps pro-abortion, that are perhaps pro-LGBTQ, that are currently being demonized, so that when a governmental shift happens, it's very easy to see who the enemies are that we need to go after. And, you know, we're somewhat living through that in the United States, where things can happen very quickly based upon 4 years, a decade, or whatnot of language that we've built up. So I would say, to summarize all of that, language, even when these groups are out of power, who they're attacking, the language that they use is the predicate for future political action. There was a very strong conservative government in the early 2000s, 2005, 2007. There was then a sort of liberal opening. The far right took control again and then lost for a couple of years. And then there was just a recent presidential election where 49.5% of folks voted for the liberal candidate, who was the mayor of Warsaw, and the slim majority retained this sort of far right president, who actually was just at the White House yesterday, I believe, at the time of this recording. There has been this back and forth. And so I do think there's a lesson to be learned that these are not just election by election questions, they're generational challenges. And that the people who were in this fight on both left and right are still in government.
Joel, you mentioned the All Polish Youth Organization earlier, and I know you've done a lot of research on them. Can you tell us more about the All Polish Youth and how it impacts the U.S.?
In 2019 and 2020, this All Polish Youth held rallies that had maybe 200,000 people that attended. And from the United States, we saw New Columbia Movement folks, we saw the Patriot Front leadership attending in Poland, because they're learning lessons. Groups like the All Polish Youth, that even when they're not doing politics, when they're out doing the work of building their movement, it's usually not in the political arena. They say that they are a national Catholic movement, but in reality, it reminds me a lot of the Proud Boys. This All Polish Youth that I study looks a lot like groups that are not religious in everyday life. They don't necessarily have a theological background. In fact, when they first restarted in the 1990s, the All Polish Youth was recruiting in white power metal bars. And they had, and actually very recently, they were handing out pamphlets with 88 and the 14 words, these sort of neo-Nazi symbols, 88 being for HH or Heil Hitler. They're recruiting metal skinheads to go and literally hurt people in the streets during these broader rallies. And so you have this vanguard group that is very interested in attacking Jewish and LGBTQ folks. In 2001, they marched throughout southern Poland with a sign that said euthanasia for queers. They've attacked gay individuals, and they just a couple years ago gave a death notice on their website for the liberal mayor of the town of Gdansk, who was then assassinated. The movement that is violent, that is part of this, League of Polish Families and the very far right Catholic identity, is using Catholicism as a cover. They're marching with a sign of Mary. They're marching with the cross, similar to the Patriot Front in the United States, marching with crosses, marching with symbols of Christianity. And then on the side, they are doing just deplorable, really tough acts of violence. And so I want to caution us that this is not just about politics. It's not about Republican and Democrat. It's about broader cultural contestation. Our communities do hang in the balance.
Joel, to what degree are some of these counter protests that you're talking about, or the counter cultural movements, framing themselves religiously as well? Is there something of like a Catholic left or a Catholic pro-democracy movement, or does it get framed as religion versus secularism?
There are many Catholic voices that are part of the broader unity coalition, the center left. Obrek is a former friar who now teaches at the University of Warsaw, who's a very strong voice for sort of liberation theology focused turn in Catholic life in Poland. Dukovets is the editor of a magazine called Contact, which bills itself as a leftist progressive Catholic identity magazine, and almost all of their writing is from a faith perspective. And there are a number of fathers and priests, like Father Biskup, who would come out for LGBTQ inclusion rallies, would be part of the leftist groups, offering blessings, introductory works, words, etc. So I do think that there is a group that is vocal, that is strong, that is giving a faith, you know, centering faith in their resistance to the Catholic far right. And I hope that that is going to be a model that we can talk about maybe more here in the United States, because I think that's where we got to go.
As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Maybe I can frame a question for you, Jonathan, this way. Everything that Joel has been describing, I think, is not how most Americans think of the European Union. Most Americans, when they hear the European Union, think of this kind of secular, liberal, kind of progressive, inclusive space. And yet here we're talking about Catholic far right youth movements that are marching in the street with deeply anti-LGBTQ messages and inflicting violence on people. How has the rest of Europe been viewing this shift that has gone on in Poland in recent decades? Or maybe it's more of a continuity than change question, but how has the broader EU coalition kind of perceived what is going on there? And how do they try to address something like this happening in one of their member states?
So when we look from a European perspective, there is really this really big idea that secularization has taken down already, or is that there isn't any base for any kind of discussion of influence of religion in public life and in policy in Europe, which is couldn't be further from the truth. As a really simple example, if we look at the flags of European nations, at least one third of them has the cross in their flag. That's just kind of really simple example to see how that on an institutional level, religion plays a big role, and a lot of churches are still state churches. And the discussion of state church, that they should be divided entities, does not correspond with a lot of their realities and constitutions. It's not a thing in Europe to have to divide between state and church. There's a lot of collaboration. Germany has, for example, they're called positive neutrality. So they want to help out religious groups, but they are neutral on which one. So there are different models. And secularization is just one part of the discussion. The other one is obviously pluralization, which is another thing we've seen, that with migration in the last 50, 60 years, there are other faith traditions coming in, as well as people are just more curious about other religion and faith like Eastern religions. So that's part of Europe as well.
I really take from that what you said about how Europeans tend to underestimate or overestimate the processes of secularization at the institutional level and at the practice level, the communal level or the social level.
Well, and I also think that there's this way that ever since the emergence of a theory of secularization, there's this concept that it's going to be a permanent shift.
Yeah.
That when secularization takes over a culture or a society, that will just be the end of history and we will have moved on from religion. The reality is these things are always dynamic. There's always back and forth and push and pull. And it sounds like, and I know from having talked to Jonathan a little bit, that the pull is happening again in Europe.
Yeah. But it's also just particularly relevant because, of course, the modern secular state arises in Europe, and starting with the Treaty of Westphalia, in response to the problem of pluralism and Catholic and Protestant competition, and as a means to try to better manage the increasing pluralism found within Europe. So Poland is not the only place, as you alluded to, where there are these movements that are arising and are contesting within the political space. So can you give us a quick survey of some of these other movements, particularly in Western Europe, that are contesting politically?
We can see that in all faith traditions in Europe, and we can see it in all kind of directions of Europe as well. We can see that in Western Europe, we can see it in Southern Europe, and we can see it in Eastern Europe as well. So if we take, for example, the Protestant Church, they're affected by that as well. They're especially influenced by secularization, and they also have that ingrowing feel, or that growing feel, that they are threatened by the rise of evangelicals and Pentecostals in Europe, which is kind of so much US inspired, especially in their language with the worship songs and the aesthetics. And they're really threatened by that because they fear that they look old school and not really relevant anymore. And therefore, there is this motion within a lot of church traditions to do something. And there is this hope that by turning political and turning towards far-right policies, there is this hope that they can have a new era of return of their importance and relevance, which they are losing. And this is hope that maybe there's a new revival by approaching far-right politics and talking points and narratives. And that's something we can see everywhere. We can see that in the UK. We can see that in Italy as well. We can see that in Hungary, and we can see that in Spain as well. So there are a lot of examples, and there isn't actually a region in Europe that isn't affected by these new dynamics to mix far-right politics.
Can you dig in a little bit to the Hungary example? Because it's one that we hear a lot of references to Orbán, especially in the US, and especially with some of these political figures that are associated with Trump and with some Christian nationalist groups sort of lifting Orbán up. And particularly the language in Hungary of Christian persecution that they see happening within Europe and more broadly, that I think appeals to some of the religious freedom or concern about Christian persecution in the US, which on its surface smacks is a bit ridiculous because Christianity is hardly under threat. It's very pervasive within the public sphere in the US and more broad. But does it link to what you're speaking to here about the desire among some Protestants to reassert tradition or strength in the face of what they see as some threats from new religious movements?
We can see in Hungary both the movement from faith communities towards Orbán, hope for a new awakening and to continue some kind of their traditionalism by really embracing the far-right government of Orbán. That's exactly how Orbán has changed the landscape of politics and religion in Hungary in order to save his popularity, in order to giving him to have this possibility to change the state and to create something that is called a Frankenstate. Because what he does is pretty clever what he did. He took the worst legislation from a lot of countries, democratic countries in the world, and mixed them together. He took the gerrymandering, got inspired from the gerrymandering from the US and took that. And then he mixed that with the winner-takes-all system that is usual in the UK. And by mixing that, he has come up with a system that doesn't give the opposition the possibility to win whatever the vote actually is. It's not just that the Christian right in Europe is getting inspired by the US Christian right in the 80s and 70s, which is something that happened 20 or that was usual 20 years ago. But now I think the trajectory has changed as well. So it's the other way around. US Christian right is looking into Hungary, and Tucker Carlson makes a documentary on Hungary. And we can see that kind of how the idea of persecution is being used as well. And you have to find someone who is the persecutor, and that's obviously the European Union that threatens him once in a while to take away his European funds that he needs in order to get his corrupt state working, actually. And that he uses actually to push Christian nationalist ideas throughout Europe as well. We have a lot of this kind of apocalyptic language, which is, I think, less frequent in Catholic environments, but really prominent in Protestant environments like Hungary, where we have Reformed churches and Protestant churches and the rise of Pentecostal churches as well. And basically all issues on gender equality, for example, are all framed like they want to hunt Christianity down. They want the European Union is coming for us, it's the Antichrist, they want to take away our rights, they want to take away our freedom and our tradition, and being Hungarian itself. The religious right in Europe is really similar to the US in a lot of things, the strategies, the topics, the main issues, the financing, but there are really two distinct factors that make, that are really interesting, and one of them is obviously the transnationalism that is, especially on the far right, really unusual in Europe. So collaboration on the far right between neo-Nazis was something that we haven't seen, or on the far right is something we haven't seen in the last, well, six decades, I guess, because all these nations in Europe, they have been in war for the last 500 centuries. So that is a really, they're really long lasting grief, especially after the Second World War. They kind of, some French intellectuals and some Austrian intellectuals, they kind of came up with the idea of ethno-nationalism, which means that, you know, all nations are basically all fine and similar and equal as long as they stay whatever they are. So that idea has developed and has mixed with religion, obviously, and especially with the convenient use of the narrative against migration since the 90s, has changed into a common European identity, which has to protect itself and its religious belief against people that are outside this created cultural identity. So basically, Christian Europeans against all kind of foreign invaders that bring their religion and want to replace us. So that's kind of something that has created the basis for this religious movements, this religious right in Europe that is incredibly tight working together. And there's another one, I'm going to keep it brief, which is the interdenominational question. Because obviously a lot of the wars in Europe throughout the last, well, actually 500 years, have always been driven by Catholics hating Protestants and Protestants hating Catholics and Catholics hating Protestants. That's how Europe has gone through the centuries. And that suddenly has changed. These ultra-conservatives on both sides suddenly have come together and then have not laid their theological issues by side, but they're just focusing on what they hate, which is gender, which is migration, which is minority rights.
We have a full episode where we're going to be talking about Russia and Ukraine and the dynamics within Russia and Ukraine. But of course, what is taking place with Russia's invasion of the Ukraine is affecting all of Europe. And it's striking that some of the language that Putin and supporters of the Russian invasion are articulating are some of these same themes of anti-EU, of gender ideology coming from the West, of secularism and the threat to tradition. But of course, Russia is trying to expand its boundaries and borders. And here in Poland, you have the history of Russian occupation. And so are they aligning with each other in support of Russia's attack against EU and secularism and so on? Or are they feeling ambivalent about it or even oppositional to those forces?
Yeah, I think that it is a fool's errand to think about Poland ever allying with Vladimir Putin. It's not in the cards.
Well, the role of Russia in Europe is really interesting during the last 20 years because Russia has been financing a lot of these far-right parties, groups, and especially religious right groups in Europe for the last 20 to 30 years. So until 3-4 years ago, in the full invasion of Ukraine, there was an incredibly sympathy and even love towards Putin and his program on families and on preserving the traditional family from Christian right and Christian nationalists all over Europe. So there was this kind of he was being seen as the free as the leader of the free world, so to speak, in their perspective, as the big savior of religion and of faith and of the family. And that obviously has to do with the soft power element, and he's providing a lot of money through these organizations and bringing far-right groups and ultra-conservative Christians in Europe together. And that, surprisingly, has changed since the invasion 3 years ago. And I think for a simple reason that most of the Christian right groups in Europe have turned away from Russia is because the whole issue, the whole war, is really close geographically to them. And obviously the money from Russia has dried up as well as a result of the sanction imposed by the European Union. And what has changed within the religious right in Europe is that they actually don't need Russian money anymore. Just as they don't need all that money coming from US, they have sources of money on their own now, and they can focus with their American partners to focus on what they see as the new frontier, which is Africa, for example, and Ghana and Nigeria and so on.
Let's think about resistance and lessons we can learn about resisting these things. And maybe we'll start with you, Joel, and again, kind of think about the case of Poland. What have effective resistance tactics looked like? What has been the approach of this kind of center-left coalition that we've been talking some about?
Poland is this model that the far right in the U.S. is looking to. And so I think that Poland is a good model for those who are interested in resistance to also look to Polish resistance. And so I'll just summarize it by saying folk religion is easily manipulated to the ends of the politically powerful. But theology is complicated. And like a really robust, vibrant left or center left or I don't care, right. Like a robust Catholic or Christian orientation that is theologically rich, that recognizes, you know, Imago Dei in the Catholic tradition. We talk about that everyone's made in the image of God, and we start there with Catholic social teaching. Something that is more robust in its theological orientation is less easily manipulated. And so when I look at Poland and Dukowicz and Contact Magazine and the sort of liberation-oriented theologians that are in Poland, their argument is not just about pluralism in the country. It's about pluralism in the church itself as part of the critique. And so I do think that leaning into faith is a lesson that I learn looking at Poland and really around the world for the United States, that articulating pluralism and space for everyone, even within my religious orientation, not rejecting my religious orientation, but leaning into it, that religious language is, I think, really key. And that leads me then to thinking about strategies. In Poland, I find strength in a pluralistic understanding of Catholic social teaching in relation to migrants. Jonathan mentions it in Hungary as well. You know, migrant support has been a really strong bright spot of resistance on the right in Poland. Like, Catholic right and Catholic left in Poland have pushed back against the government on its support for refugees. And I think that there's an opportunity in the United States for the Christian right and the Christian center or left, however folks ideologically talk about themselves, they are nonetheless Christian. And for Christians to talk about moral questions in light of the gospel, migrants, family separation.
Of talking about resistance and having worked kind of a decade in campaigning, as well as having interviewed hundreds of pro-democratic faith leaders in the last year for Faith and Democracy, I have a few general takeaways. So one thing I really discovered that works in a lot of contexts all over Europe, and I think beyond as well, is that democratic movements and faith movements, they win when they don't defend the status quo. And they say, well, everything is doing fine. We just have to resist the far right. We just have to stop them. And then everything will be fine because everything is fine right now. And that's not working. We have, and the resistance has to offer an alternative that embraces and improves the livelihood of people. And understands that the system is broken, and it's been broken for a really long time, and it doesn't serve the majority of the population worldwide, is not sustainable, and we have to change the way we live and we organize ourselves. The other one learning I really saw in a lot of campaigns in Europe and beyond that works is that we have to bridge the silos we have built between the faith world and the secular world and organizations. If we are fighting against the same threats, which is the erosion of democracy and taking away our rights, we have to work with people that have the similar aim, just other ways of seeing the issue or other focuses, and maybe are not faith-based. So we have to work together, otherwise we won't be successful. And therefore, I think the question is not only what can we learn from other resistance groups, but actually the question I find even more interesting is what can we learn from the religious right that they are doing right, because they're doing a lot of things really well. So we have to learn from them as well and turn the playbook and say, well, we can do that as well, this kind of organizing, just better and based on human rights. So the third point I think is really important is to show international solidarity. And that's not just about sending money, but also if we have shared tools, if we have platforms, if we have digital tools that work in campaigning, if we have ideas and narratives, we have to get together and share them and say, well, we have figured out this app that works in order to reach young people. All right, it's a really practical advice, but I think let's share it, let's translate it, let's try something that is working in Poland, let's try it, adapt it culturally, and try to do it in Uganda. Let's work with people on the ground and figure out how we can do that. And the last point is that I think is really important is not to fall to the illusion that we just have to find a compromise with the far right and with people that don't agree on fundamental human rights. We can't agree. That's a really European perspective now, but we can't work with fascists. That's as European as I can be today. I mean, that's peak Europe experience. That's especially as an Italian German, I kind of have, I sense that kind of, I really have that impulse to share that. There can't be compromise with people that want to, then don't recognize the human worth of people that don't look like them or don't believe the same thing. There can't be any kind of compromise with those people on few issues like human rights, because that's where we lose ourselves.
I want to two-finger on that, if that's okay. And I agree. And I want to add a little bit more texture to it, however, and feel free to push back. You know, where I find a lot of hope that we can work across ideology, even repugnant ideologies, whether we're left or right, is at the local level. And I think that the Catholic Church in particular gets this really right, that can bridge ideology in important ways. We all practice the same mass together at the local level, that it's unifying across boundaries, but it also means that at the local level, giving alms to the poor, doing Catholic rituals or Christian rites and practices, that at the parish level, at the local level, we are seeing charity for migrants in practice, even if those same people are voting for somebody that we think is a fascist. And that the orientation, I think, that allows us the most bridging, the location and geography that allows us to bridge the most, is not the global, but actually the hyper-local. And that if we think about not Christian nationalism or Catholic nationalism, but think about Catholic or Christian localism, thinking about the location of the school, the city, the neighborhood, I actually think that there are incredible points of practical commonality where people on the right and people on the left can actually come together and build community together that can ultimately scale up and bridge ideology. That is pro-democratic bridging in action. That is taking place in Poland. It is taking place in my neighborhood and in parishes around the world. And that is the thing that gives me the most amount of hope, that even if I regard someone as degrading the human rights of my friends, that there are points of practice and commonality and common humanity that we can still pull people back from. And I'm never going to give up hope that we can pull people back from fascism.
Thank you both so much, Joel and Jonathan. This has been fascinating. I have learned so much, and I am very, very grateful for both your scholarship and your activism. And we're very glad to have you in our coalition.
You guys are the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was great. Great discussion.
Joel Day is the managing director of the Notre Dame Democracy Initiative, and Jonathan Lomascolo is the deputy director of Faith in Democracy. If you haven't checked out Faith in Democracy, you should. It's a new NGO that is trying to counter the global far right using and immobilizing religious communities. Jonathan is also the editor of The Christian Right in Europe, which came out in 2023. Stick around for a few minutes. Susie and I have a few more reflections before we close.
Okay, so Matt, I know you're more focused on Protestant movements and trends in U.S. Christian nationalism, but how is the Catholic nationalism that we heard about from Joel especially similar to or different from forms of Catholic nationalism as you're familiar with it in the U.S.? Are there shared players, I would assume, like J.D. Vance or Steve Bannon?
Well, as Joel was saying, there's definitely a lot of cross-pollination between the far-right Catholics in Poland and far-right Catholics in the U.S. I mean, if you think about some of what J.D. Vance has done, even within the first 10, 11, 12 months of this administration, he has been advocating for a lot of these far-right coalitions in Europe and trying to push back against the way that the EU is trying to regulate some of these authoritarian movements and trying to police them a little bit. So Vance has been advocating for Hungary and for Poland and for the far-right parties in Germany. But as we noted, only about 20 to 25% of the U.S. population, depending on which poll you're looking at and how they ask the question, only about 20 to 25% of the U.S. population identifies as Catholic, whereas somewhere north of 70% of Polish residents are Catholic. So Catholics are a very influential part of the Christian right in the U.S., but they've always been a minority voice within that coalition, whereas Protestants make up the majority. One of the main places where Catholics in the U.S., and I'd even argue globally, have punched above their weight on the right is in their intellectualism. And if you look at some of the major strands of Christian nationalism and Christian supremacy in the U.S. and around the world, the more intellectual architecture of that is often being built by Catholic intellectuals, people that go by the names the integralists or the post-liberals or sometimes the common sense constitutionalists. And these all have these very erudite and academic arguments that play well with think tanks and constitutional lawyers and Supreme Court justices. And these have all been underpinning the Christian right. And they've been very influential with Christian nationalists as frameworks. But the main point I'd make here about Poland is, this is something I've really actually learned in conversation with Joel over the last few years, is that Polish Catholic nationalism seems to be more an inspiration and influence to the less intellectual and more action-oriented elements within the Catholic far right. So it's the militias like the Proud Boys or Patriot Front and these far-right Catholic youth groups in the U.S. that are looking to Poland as a model. So it's less that it's providing this kind of intellectual frame and more that it's the implementation of Catholic far-right ideas that is being enacted in Poland that is seen as an inspiration to a lot of these more militant groups in the U.S.
Yeah. And you mentioned J.D. Vance going and stumping for some of these far-right groups in Europe, especially at the beginning of the administration. I remember part of that was he was also articulating or jumping on the bandwagon, I should say, of a lot of the anti-EU narrative and activism in those spaces. So Jonathan spoke about the anti-EU currents that are operating within some of these Christian nationalist groups in Europe. And I think that resonates with some of the anti-globalist narratives generally in the U.S. They're often in the U.S. getting directed more towards the United Nations than the EU, but there's definitely some, they got some hate for the EU as well. But all of that, anti-international organizations, it reflects the shift post-World War II. There in the immediate post-World War II era, all of these institutions were really built from scratch or strengthened during that period. And there was an ethos and an infrastructure for this kind of international partnerships in order to ensure that what happened during World War II wouldn't happen again. But the pendulum seems to have swung very hard now away from international legal systems as a mean to curtail, both ethno-nationalist violence and then forms of invasions between countries. To get back to what we heard in the South Korea episode, we're not being haunted nearly enough or any longer by the ghost of World War II. And or the forces of ethno-nationalism and anti-democracy activism have caught up with and dismantled the systems that were created right after World War II in order to try to contain those elements and the violence of those forces.
Yeah, I mean, that would be in many ways another way of stating the thesis of this series, right? That the order that was set up after World War II in terms of international agreements and these sorts of things is breaking down. And now we're seeing the emergence of new forms of fascism, new forms of nationalism that are pushing back with these more local and patriarchal and parochial concerns and defying in many ways the international systems that have maintained a relative peace around the world. And it's very, very dangerous. I was also struck, Susie, by the way that Joel talked about this kind of generational conflict, right? He talked about how these conflicts between the religious far right and more pluralistic center-left coalitions are going to be generational. And I've got bad news for all the people out there in the U.S. who are just thinking, I'm going to bury my head in the sand and just avoid reading the news until Trump is out of office and we get back to normal. This is the new normal, what we're living with right now. And the rise of far-right authoritarian politics in the U.S. isn't going to be put to bed if the Democrats win in 2028. Probably for the rest of most of our lives, we will see this cultural struggle between far-right Christians and pluralistic democracy, both in the U.S. and around the world. And some analysts would look at the fights about religion and Christian nationalism as just more quote-unquote culture wars. That's that kind of snide phrase that we use in American politics for these kind of religious and moral conflicts. And they would say, well, the real fight is economics. The real fight is political philosophy. But I would argue what we are experiencing right now is a tidal religious shift in our politics. It's a seismic shift. And the outcome of that shift is not going to be predictable. But I think Joel is right that these political battles that are about religion, that are about morality, that are about how we ground our identity as a society, about how much toleration there can be for real sexual diversity or LGBTQ rights or racial diversity. These are enduring arguments that aren't just going to, we aren't going to just progress past these things, right? As I think some people may have naively anticipated at the end of the 20th century, these are going to be enduring battles because they're tapping into some of the most deepest parts of meaning making and identity that we have. I'm also really grateful for Jonathan and for his voice. I've searched around, and Jonathan Lomasciolo is the person I've found more than any other analyst that I have encountered who can speak about the whole picture in Europe and what's happening with the far right in Europe. He helped edit a volume about it, in fact. And that's really hard to do because you've got like 27 countries in the EU and many different religion state arrangements. If you go back after the Reformation and all the religious wars in Europe, it's a real mess when it comes to quote unquote church and state. But something Jonathan said to me in another conversation that I had with him has really stayed with me. We were talking about this idea of revival and conversions to Christianity and how in Europe, as in the US, there's a lot of talk about revival and there's this energy around that concept. Jonathan agreed with me that you're seeing that in Europe, that kind of conversation. But he also estimated that the majority of people who were converting to Christianity in Europe today were joining these far-right styles of Christianity, like the hardline Catholics we see in Poland, because that's where the energy is. That's the excitement. They're not all joining Catholicism, but they're joining these more extreme movements. Now, this is often what Christians will talk about when they say that there's a revival going on, right? More people are converting. There's more energy behind certain religious ideas. And I don't have anything against Christians talking about revival per se, but we always need to ask when we are talking about revival, what is being revived, right? I really worry that what a lot of these movements in Europe and the US and Korea and Brazil that we've seen that say that they're all about revival, they're often just reviving or revivifying Christian imperialism and Christian nationalism and these ideas of Christian superiority over others and tapping into that really ugly legacy of Christendom and Christian colonialism. So yeah, great. If people want to talk about revival, that can be a good thing. But we always need to pay attention to what is actually getting activated in that revival. Are people going deeper in their spirituality and their love for other people? Or are they just attaching themselves to the bandwagon of Christian superiority?
Great point. Okay, so I want to turn to resistance lessons. And there are three from our conversation that I want to pull out in particular. So first, and it gets to a point you were saying earlier, Matt, about this being a generational fight. We can't just be looking at elections and doing our organizing around elections and getting certain folks elected. That's important, but that's not going to be enough because this goes deeper and this is going to be a longer fight than any election cycle. And it's really about creating that broader and larger movement. And here, there was something said in passing that there's a lot we can learn from right-wingers about how to build movements effectively. The pillars of society that are crucial: education, media, religion, the judiciary, the various on-ramps for folks to become involved, the ability to offer clearly what our diagnosis is and our prescription. I can't tell you how often I hear from my organizer friends and from some of my congregants that I need to stop with all of my academic jargon or my third order theology, and I just need to talk real to folks. That is something many of us on the left need to work on, making our big ideas and our visions far, far more accessible and relatable, especially to the vast majority of folks who just don't have time for big visions or words. The right is really good at that, and we aren't. Okay, and then two, once again, as both Joel and Jonathan were encouraging, we can't be relying on non-religious language and frames entirely or even primarily. And this gets to what you were just saying, Matt, because I think oftentimes in places where religious extremism is on the rise, It's often as a result of lack of religious education and literacy. Those who are most easily sort of radicalized within religious frames often don't have a religious education to begin with. And so they're sort of more easily manipulated by being told what their religions teach or preach about things. And so, again, the solution is not less religion or no religion. The solution is actually more religion in some ways, but a different religion. So Joel spoke about Imago Dei and Catholic social teachings and liberation theology. And this is not the first time we've heard about liberation theology. We've heard about that in every episode so far that has talked about Christian nationalism.
I think it has literally been mentioned in every episode.
Yes,
but I'd have to go back and check.
It has. I did. And it's because these liberation theology, but also these other ideas, like Imago Dei, these are rich, powerful ideas. They are entire moral systems that were handed down to us from our spiritual ancestors. They are the tools that got them through their own times of trial and oppression. And we have to gather up that wisdom. We have to tap into the vast millennia-old theological storehouse of our religious traditions, of cultural traditions and spiritual traditions, the language, the practices, the organizing principles, the systems of mutual aid that exist outside of the state that have been used by religious and cultural communities for millennia. Our spiritual ancestors handed down these tools to us for a reason, for our well-being, to carry us forward. And then the third thing, and it's getting us back to something that we ended our last episode with, which is that the women resistors are badass. So we have so much to learn from women like Podlasna and the other women's rights activists who joined her in the resistance in Poland. And that anecdote that I started with, that's just one. You can go, listeners, on the web and see about some of the other things that she and women rights activists have been doing in Poland and be inspired. Or remember those women in Myanmar who hung up their sarongs over the streets to scare off the male security actors. And there's so many other examples like that. And these women activists around the world are reaching back to us with outstretched hands, sort of inviting us into this global solidarity. So it's just a good reminder to me that we really aren't alone.
Yeah. And on that point about the use of these symbols, I mean, there's this ambiguity sometimes when it comes to religious versus national symbols. So Our Lady of Częstochowa is both a religious symbol and a national symbol. And so you have to be a little careful when you're playing around with people's religious symbols. But I think that's a very effective case study in how to transmute some of these national symbols into protest symbols. And I think Americans on the center left, we really need to claim our national symbols in this moment, right? So let me just throw out an idea for how we can do a kind of center left style patriotism, and maybe it can spark something for someone or start something. Do you know that one of the slogans of the American Revolution was "Rebellion against tyrants is obedience to God"?
I did not.
Rebellion against tyrants is obedience to God. That is a fantastic slogan, right? Like, kudos to our founders. In fact, in a little bit of background, there had been some preaching within kind of, I think it was Congregationalist churches. Hey, in the lead up to the revolution, they were reinterpreting the Bible, reinterpreting famous passages like Romans 13 that Christian nationalists often use to say that you need to submit to the governing authorities. Well, there was scriptural reinterpretation and new theology going on in the lead up to the revolution. And so then these new sentiments started sparking in the American populace, and including among the founders. So I think that should be the slogan of the Christian resistance movement in the U.S. in 2026, the 250th anniversary. We fought a revolutionary war to get rid of the divine right of kings, and now we have people trying to recreate the divine right of kings through Trump, right? Rebellion against tyrants is obedience to God. Put it on your sign.
Yeah, I love that. And it resonates with the No Kings protest, right? The only thing I would say is it wasn't a new interpretation to bring that into the gospel. There is all throughout both the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures. It's what theological currents are you lifting up and over and above some of the others.
Touche. It was due to them.
It's true. All right. So next episode, we will not be leaving feminist activists nor religious icons behind. They are going to feature in our turn to Russia, Ukraine, and Orthodox Christianity's entanglement with ethno-nationalism and authoritarianism. So please do join us.
That's it for this episode of American Unexceptionalism. Thanks for joining us.
Please hit subscribe and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts.
You can keep up with this show and all the other great series from Axis Mundi Media at www.axismundi.us.
This show is produced by Andrew Gill and engineered by Scott Okamoto. Funding provided by the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies, Princeton Theological Seminary, and the International Center on Religion and Diplomacy.
Until next time, remember, the struggle for democracy is global, and we aren't alone.